Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now. America, how are you this week? We survived another week in this country. This is We Talk Productions that presents Black Urban America, which come on Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also on Saturday, we have Provocative Thought with Carlton Steed. He also airs on Saturdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have our marketing partnership program, which helps small business owners and self-employed people to get the exposure they need nationally and internationally. If you're interested in any small business or any person that have their own products or services that want expansion, dial 404-573-6144. Dial 404-573-6144. Tonight, I have a special guest on who will be earning his doctorate next year, I believe. And we're going to be discussing mental illness. And I know there are a lot of preconceived notions about mental illness and mental health. I know the exposure or the treatment that you have received in different community mental health centers across this country has not always been the most pleasant experience. However, there has been an increase. There have been increase in the mental health, our participation as clients in the mental health field. And I'd like to welcome Professor Brandon Simpson. How are you this evening?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. I'm fine. Welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, no problem. I was glad to do it.
Yeah. And I'd like to ask you one question before I start exploring some of these issues in the concerning mental health and the African-American community. Why did you want to pursue a doctorate in psychology?
Well, I chose to pursue my doctorate in educational psychology because I just saw the treatment of Black males that were in special education. When I began my research, what I was starting to see was it's almost as if Black males, if they show any kind of behavior, whether it be, you know, acting out, not paying attention in class, the first thing that a lot of teachers want to do is place them in special education. And it seems like in special education is where these kids get left behind. So I was just starting to see Black females, white males, white females were on one side and Black males were kind of off on their own. And I would see where, especially if the kid was good at playing sports, if if there's a black male and he's good at playing sports, most of the schools will focus on sports and not the education. And then from some of the schools I've been in, I would kind of look at the special education classrooms. And in those classrooms, it seems that they're not focusing on education. They focus on life skills because it's almost as if these kids are not expected to get a high school diploma and go forward in whatever field they may choose to go into. So that was something that I began to see, and I wanted to get more research into that. You know, and not only that, you know, I currently also work in with disability services at the USC campus located in Union, South Carolina. So I kind of began to study, you know, disabilities, learning disabilities. And a lot of our black males seem to be taught in the school system that if you have a learning disability, then you need to either play sports, learn life skills, because there's nothing else out there for you.
Well, they don't encourage certain vocational skills such as construction, electrician, you know, skills, labor skills, high labor skills. They don't encourage a person with learning disability to pursue that avenue?
To be honest with you, they really don't, from what I've seen here with some of the schools in South Carolina. What is in particular one school I was at, in their special education classroom, there was an entire kitchen teaching the kids how to cook, how to clean, how to take out the garbage, and, you know, they're not seeing those things. And there was an incident of another student from a high school here in South Carolina who was a football player, but he had a learning disability. But the school focused him on in playing sports. It was not teaching him any of the things that you just spoke of. He had a drive. He wanted to go off to college. At that time, I was not in the position that I am now of working in disability services. And I had not come into teaching, so I did not know of any services that would be available for him. But this particular student, you know, it was just, he just got left behind. So once he graduated, it was kind of along the lines of, well, thank you for coming to school all these years and playing football for us, but we don't have nothing else we can offer you. So good luck out there in the real world. So, you know, I'm starting to see that, you know, although we would like to see those things, you know, they do have those machine classes, you know, those building construction classes. They do have those going on in the schools. But from what I'm seeing, and, you know, and I'm speaking from my own personal experience, I'm not seeing that happen with a lot of the special education kids, those, especially with the black males, because that special education label places a stigma on those kids where it's, he can't learn, or, you know, he's special, and we're going to have to, you know, it takes a long time for him to learn. So we're starting, and I'm starting to see a lot of teachers who won't take the time out to give this particular student the attention he needs. Not saying that there's a teacher out there who won't do that, who won't take his or her time out to work with kids, you know, that need that. But there are those that, you know, especially if it's a student with a behavioral issue, you know, a lot of the teachers are just going to pass them on. Now, when I worked, while I was working for AMI, which is Associated Marine Institutes, and we're in partnership with the Department of Juvenile Justice, AMI offered programs like that for those kids that were, you know, because basically what AMI is, it's a kind of like a wilderness camp for kids that are involved with DJJ,
mm-hmm.
you know, without being behind bars. So We do offer those things. Those things are offered at those programs, such as construction, maybe embroidery. Some of the kids will learn how to build the cornhole boards. So, and we enable often go out in the community and do things that dealt with construction. And I would also get some of the teachers from the technical college to come down and talk to them about mechatronics, automotive, building construction, and those things. And a good majority of those kids that I dealt, that I worked with while I was there, they were special education. But I think we have gotten in a place where we've gotten in a place where if a kid is in a special education class, you know, he is stuck with that, that he can't learn, he can't learn. And I've seen kids that are special education that do learn and learn well. And then there is the kid that does not need special education. It could be that he is a lot smarter than he has let on. When a lot of kids, what I've seen happen with some kids is that if they are a lot smarter and the classroom is moving at a slower pace than it should be for them, then that kid, he may tend to act out. Him or her may tend to act out. It does not mean that they need special education. It just means they may need to be in a faster curriculum to meet their educational needs.
Well, let me ask you this, Professor. Do you feel that special education, the special education system is, do you think it's by design that more black males are in special ed?
I believe it is by design. From what I've seen, and it's almost like I said, it's almost as if a black male comes into a school early on, and we're talking maybe preschool, kindergarten, and that he acts out, and he's placed in special education, or he gets that label. That label follows him throughout school, and that is where we get the student that is actually left behind, because there's that one teacher that's like, well, I'm not going to deal with him. You know, he's doing this, he's doing that. I'm not going to deal with him, so I'm going to pass him on to the next. And I'm going to pass him to the next person and let him or her deal with him. So I would say it is by design. I think there needs to be some changes in the system in regards to education.
What are some of the changes that you think that ought to happen in the special educational system?
Well, I think you have to take into consideration, first of all, evaluating the kid's educational level. Even if he does act out, I think testing should focus on more than just one particular subject. I think everybody has a subject that they may struggle with. I myself struggled in math when I was in school. I struggled with math, and I would act out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would act out in the classroom. But I think that we have to, the system itself has to find a way to, address the issues that the kid struggles with in order for him to be successful in the classroom. I think that it's hard. I would say, to me, it may be hard to kind of pinpoint certain things, but I do think that we need to take into consideration the kid's demographics, the background, of course, what's happening in the home, is there an educational focus in the home? Because I have met kids where education was not the focus in the home, and, education was not a focus in the home. They would just come home. Parents went around to say, hey, you need to sit down, do your homework, we need to go over this, we need to go over that. So there are just a lot of factors that has to be taken into consideration when making these necessary changes to our special education system. That along with, we also have to look at the teachers. we have to look at the teachers, because I do think there's a little bit of, and maybe a lot of, racial bias, you know, when it comes to dealing with some black males. You know, there is some bias there. Well, you know, I don't want to deal with him because, you know, of where he may come from. If there's a kid that comes from a, you know, not so good neighborhood, then there's also a stigma there. Well, he's from over there, he can't learn. You know, we're just going to do whatever. So, some teachers have those perceptions, and some of those perceptions can be dangerous to our young black males. Those teacher perceptions can be dangerous to our young black males, which can in a way be a hindrance for them learning, because
you know something, it's interesting that you should say that, because you would think in a school building, in a school environment, in a school atmosphere, that the professional staff people will be open-minded than any other discipline or part of society. Well, I can understand law enforcement having their bias because that's the way they're trained. But, you know, you talk about teachers, guidance counselors, principals, support staff, what have you, having this racial bias towards a 14, 15, 13-year-old? You think there would be some type of objectivity there.
Yes. I mean, even as a high school student myself, we were told, and it became so obvious, you know, after when I became a junior and senior in high school, our guidance counselors would tell all of us black students about, you know, the technical college that we could go to or the trade school that we could go to. They never talked with us about going to a college. They never talked with us about going to college.
But they've been doing that. You know, I mean, they're still doing that. They were doing that back in the 20s and the 30s. You know, if you watch the movie Malcolm X, you know, when he was a little boy, he wanted to be a lawyer. He said, no, be a welder.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong being a welder. Welders make good money, and we need welders to build our homes and our buildings and what have you. And if you talk about rebuilding the nation, you need the welders, construction workers. But if a kid wanted to go to college, where's the, I mean, how can you say that today in 2018? It'll be 2018 in about 60 days. So
and you're
that's
right.
Still going on?
And it is. And that was back when I was in high school in 95, 96. And you know, I never saw them when they would do college days. They never brought an HBCU there. The first time I saw them bring an HBCU there was maybe possibly my junior year, which was around about 95 maybe. And they brought an HBCU. The first HBCU I saw them bring there was Benedict College. And then they brought Voorhees College there, which is where I ended up going. I ended up getting accepted into Voorhees College. But, you know, we still see that. You know, we see, you know, young black males get that stigma. You know, they get, especially those in special education. And, you know, even those that get put in what they call the self-contained class, because they've gotten to, those are the ones who teachers just feel like they can't handle, so they have to be in a structured environment. What happens is when those kids get put in those self-contained classes, they're isolated from the rest of their peers. So they have that thought. It's almost as if they're conditioned to believe, well, being that they separate me from all the other kids, I can't learn. I can't learn. I can't do this. I can't do that because they have separated me from my peers. So while all of the other kids are in classroom having a good educational experience, our black males that are in special education or in those self-contained classrooms, they're just sitting there. They may not even be learning anything. You know, they're being taught those life skills, you know, in which there's nothing wrong with teaching these kids life skills, because you need those. You need those life skills. But these kids have to be educated in something. During my time at AMI, several of the kids would tell me that they prefer to go to the alternative school versus a regular school because they said they learned more at the alternative school because there's less kids at the alternative school versus in the public school where there's a lot of kids and there's a lot of kids there. So those kids that were at the alternative school said that they learned a lot. They learned more because the teachers took time out with them, kind of gave them that one-on-one attention that they needed in order to be successful in the class. So once, and I've known several kids, once they got out of the alternative school and returned to regular high school or middle school, they would always end up going back to the alternative school because they could not function well with the teachers or anything else, and then they would go back to the alternative school, and you would have a kid that would just flourish, that would thrive and make educational ground. I'll give you an example. One of the kids in our program, he was special education. He was actually placed on the GED track because our education director at the time said there's no way he can get a diploma.
Wow.
And, you know, of course,
wow.
You know, he had this attitude about him that, you know, he had this tough attitude. He would curse out staff. And I began to work with him because I worked there as a counselor. Began to work with him and talk with him. And you know, we built a rapport. And, you know, when I was talking to him about achievement and going forward, going to college and doing those things, when he left our program, he actually had a grade point average of a 3.2, to which, you know, of course, the education director was completely surprised. Yes.
That's a B average.
The education director. Yeah, that's a B average. He had a B average when he left our program. So that said, that kind of let me know right there that even when these kids are labeled, given that label of special education, that does not mean that they can't learn. They can learn. I believe anybody can learn. If you sit down and you take the time with that person to help them learn.
Hey, you know what, Professor? You want to know what the results are? You want to know what the results are? The results are gang violence. You got close to 800,000 kids in gangs across this country. Especially when you separate from the peers, you're already grooming them psychologically for jail and prison. And we, black and brown, 80-some percent, which also take us from the community and most importantly, it take us from our families. 1.2 million black fathers in the penal system across this country. Those are the results. And these are not my numbers,
that is
their numbers.
Mm-hmm, that is correct. You know, in my particular program, when we were at full capacity, we were at 34 kids. And out of 34 kids, maybe 25, 26 were black. You know, which left the rest of the kids were either white or Latino. And a lot of the kids, we would get kids in our program that were, say, 16. Our program ranged in age from 13 to 17 years old. So we would get kids that were of that age range who could not even read. They were reading on a kindergarten, first grade, or second grade level. And, you know,
they lose the battle right there.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, excuse me for cutting you off, Professor. Let me ask you something.
You're fine.
Let me ask you something. What is the composition of the teaching staff and administration as well as the superintendent?
Okay. Excuse me. In the particular county of which I live in here in South Carolina, which is Lawrence County, I attended school in Clinton, and the majority of the teaching staff, the majority of the teachers, administration, along with superintendent, I would say the majority would be maybe 90% white, maybe 95% white, I would probably say higher than that. Let's take it up to maybe 97-98% white, with just that, not that 1%, 1-2%, where there is someone who's black. You know, we find now the only area to, you know, from my own experience, you know, I would say I see more black men as coaches, you know, in the sport, as coaches.
Which, of course,
there's nothing wrong with
of
that.
Of course, let's look at the pattern here. When we're young in high school, we played football, basketball, run track, baseball. You know, play sports. We participate in the sports, and then we sit our merry way with those sorry those negative statistics that I just shot at you. Mm-hmm. And of course, who are we going to have? A black man, a coach. Again, being involved in sports. Why can't he be? In some states, you got to have a teaching degree to be a coach in high school. In some states, you don't have to. But Pennsylvania, New York, you got to be a teacher to be a coach. And so, I find this very disheartening that nothing has changed over the last 50 years. I'm not talking about the last 20, I'm talking about the past 50 years. My mother was told that she couldn't be us. Well, back then, there weren't no black secretaries. She graduated from business school, and they would hire her as a secretary.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a shame that this has been going on and on and on and on. And the thing I'm looking at, what is academia going to do in our community to try? Well, I say academia because we have a lot of professors that teach, but it's not involved in the communities. Like you won the rare mm-hmm. one. They just go and teach their courses to prepare people, you know, for their discipline. But to be active in the community and teaching and acting and going to school, that's rare. And I have to commend you for doing it. But where's academic? You know, they come on these shows as our representatives, and really I think that they're just performing. So what is academia is going to do to address, I guess, the black man perception or our conditions in the community? What's academia going to do?
I think what academia has to do is let the black community know of the opportunities and the doors that education can open. We have to get our parents involved. We have to get the community involved. The things that you speak of, my dad, he would tell me those things as a kid. He would tell me and my brothers those same things coming up. And here at my house, when it's coming up, you had to go to school. Education was the number one priority. If you did not want to go to school, my dad was going to make you leave. Was going to make you leave his house. So we have to get back. Not saying that we've moved away from that, but we have to let our kids know the importance of education, because I have met kids that they see school as just, well, what I need to go for. I'm not learning anything. You know, I'm not learning anything. You know, and then I've met parents who don't focus on education. You know, other things are priority, you know, and I can understand why, because I've met those parents, a lot of single mothers who have to focus on, you know, other things, trying to put food on the table, trying to go to work, trying to make sure the kids are taken care of. So I do understand that. I think that a lot of teachers, especially, you know, those teachers of color, those male and female, we kind of have to step outside of the box. You know, we, just as you said, teachers get comfortable teaching their class and then going home at the end of the day. You know, they're not getting out into the community talking to the other kids. I also have a, I have a brother that teaches at Burke County High School in Hepsiba, Georgia. And me and him are always talking, and he's always saying how he gets out there with those kids and, you know, let these kids know what they can, you know, the opportunities that education can provide. I think that we have, you know, we have lost that in our community, that the doors that education can open up. We see the students, you know, they're doing the regular curriculum, but if a kid is good in math and science, then we need to turn him or her to that field, because there's opportunities out there that they can reach, you know, and places where we should be seeing our young people go. We're not seeing that. We have to get to a point where we have to say enough is enough. We don't want to see any more of our kids shot down in the streets. We don't want to see any more of our kids incarcerated. We have to get back to that point where education is number one and doors will open up. We can see that those doors will open up. I was that kid at one time. I actually wanted to drop out of school. I wanted to drop out of school in the ninth grade. I didn't see education doing anything for me. And my dad was along the lines of, he said, if you drop out, you're leaving here. And he was very passionate about education. He made me stay. When I did finish high school, him and my mom were like, well, it's your choice what you want to do, go to college, whatever. And I chose to go to college. But he pushed us to go into, he pushed education so hard because he grew up in segregation and he did not get to go to school like he should have, because he had to go work in the cotton field. You know, he had, my granddad was a sharecropper. And so when they were kids, they would get pulled out of school to go work in the fields to go pick cotton. And my dad was not, he was not a great reader. He could read, but he could not read he did not have a high level of reading. But if you put a math problem in front of him, he would solve it quick, fast, and in a hurry. You know, he was quick with math. But, you know, he struggled in reading.
You gotta count that money.
Why he pushed education. yeah, he knew how to count his money. But he pushed, that's why he pushed education. I think we have to get back to that, and we have to get academia to stand up, you know, and that's what I'm hoping to do with the work, with the research that I'm doing, to try to get academia to stand up and say, you know, even in academics, okay, enough is enough. We have to figure out a better way of teaching these young boys that are being placed in special education. These kids, they don't need it. Some of them don't need it, whereas there are those that do need special education, but they just need someone to give them that one-on-one time. You know, and I've met in my position at USC Union of Disabilities Coordinators, I have met several people who have felt that, wow, I didn't think my child could come to college.
Excuse me.
So I always link them up with services that'll help them help them with their educational needs. I make sure they get their accommodations. We have a student success center, which is kind of like a study hall, and we have tutors coming in and out. I always talk with our dean, and our dean has said that, you know, he made the statement to me that we're not going to turn down anybody. And he said anybody can learn. So there are colleges out there. All colleges have a disability services department. So, you know, just because your child is in special education does not mean he cannot learn and he cannot go to college.
Okay, you might have a caller here. Hold on. Yes, welcome to Black Urban America. 6818, you're on the line. You have a question or comment?
I'll give him a call.
You're on the line. You have a question or comment?
No.
Oh, okay. Continue to listen. Professor, something that you, that was striking to me. How can we get? How can we get far more black men in our communities to help these young men? It appears that there have been a lack of participation from us to work with our young men. How can we strike? How can we motivate these men? Because a lot of these men are scared then to these young men. So how can we change the relationship between older men working with younger men?
Okay. I think we have, you know, I would say those that are already working with young men, you know, young men like that who are in special education or involved with DJJ, those guys that are already doing the work, I feel like they have to get out there and get in the community to get, you know, to take away the stigma, you know, to take away that stigma of, you know, these are just bad kids, you know, and that's not always the case. That's not always the case. It's not, you know, the kids are stereotyped. Well, if you have, you know, DJJ involvement, then it's, whoa, he's involved with DJJ, he's a bad kid, or she's a bad kid. That's not necessarily the case.
There go the labels again.
We have to get past those labels first. You know, we have to get past those labels, and those that are doing the work have to get out there in the community and talk with someone, you know, and talk with someone who, you know, talk with those people. Go, you know, whether it's going to the church, going to, you know, town meetings, council meetings, and coming up with different programs. You know, here I'm thinking it might be a nationwide program, the Call Me Mister program, that, you know, they have at Clemson University. That's you know, those are, there are programs like that, and there's another program in the city of Union, which is called Brothers United, that helps the kids in the community. You know, I myself have go up to another AMI camp, which is Camp White Pines, and I help those kids register to take online classes at USC Union. We have to step out there. You know, we have to get past our nervousness, the anxiety, get past those labels that those kids might have, because, you know, it's just all about grabbing somebody else by the hand and pulling them along. You know, and I think the older generation sees it as, well, so many of these kids are disrespectful. They're this, they're that. Okay, well, maybe you can teach them how to be respectful. Maybe you can teach them some things that, you know, some things that you grew up with, some values, some beliefs that you grew up with, and you can pass on to him, and you both can learn from each other. You know, you both can learn from each other. One of my students said to me today that he kind of, we were in class, he said that one of my high school students, he said he kind of argues with his parents. So he said his parents don't understand the way things are today because they're older. And I told him, I said, well, you're going to have to teach them, you know, you're going to have to talk to them, you know. And I would say when it comes to men, you know, you know, in a way we're kind of conditioned not to express ourselves or express our feelings. We get caught with the, oh, well, he's soft, or, you know, we have to express it. We have to let people know, you know, you have to let the next man know what's going on. If that means you have to break down and cry, then break down and cry. There's no shame in that. You know, so most often men are conditioned to, you know, maintain, you know, stand tall, stand strong, don't show emotion. And you kind of have to get past that, because sometimes these kids that are in these particular situations, sometimes they need just a handshake or a hug or how you doing, a good morning, you know. So we have to, you know, we have to get past those labels, get past that anxiety, and just basically step out on faith and try to reach, you know, reach out to, in the community to the kids, to pass on, you know, to help these kids get where they need to be.
I want to switch the focus a little bit.
Okay.
What is mental health, really? What is mental health?
Okay. Well, mental health can be, I always sum it up as, because a lot of it to help my students understand, I would say mental health is having a healthy mind. Because our brain can get sick. You know, our brain can get sick. So I always say mental health is having a healthy mind. If you are sick, if your mind becomes sick, then you have to take the necessary steps to keep your mind healthy. And that could be taking, you know, how we provide, you know, providing self-care, taking care of yourself, eating the right foods, eating the right foods, developing coping skills that help with stress.
Mm-hmm.
Because some, you know, we know
a lot of us die from stress, you know, because that's what high blood pressure is. That's what high blood pressure.
Yeah, stress, you know, stress causes, you know, like just like you said, high blood pressure. Stress can also lead into depression. So that's how I see mental health, you know, developing coping skills and when you're at times of when you're emotional or you're anxious and you have a lot of anxiety. And it's just maintaining a healthy mind, because if you don't have a healthy mind, you won't have a healthy body. So you have to get yourself, you know, you have to take care of your mind. And right now, you know, we're starting to see mental health in the news a lot, especially with these recent shootings. You know, we're seeing mental health in the news, you know, and most often when a crime is committed, that is the first defense. Well, he or she has mental health issues, you know, and we're seeing mental health being thrown into the spotlight.
That's the new buzzword now. That's the new buzzword. I read somewhere, Maddie Wong said African Americans are 20% more likely to have some form of mental illness today. Why is that?
I think we.
Or is that true? Or is that true?
I would say it is true that we do, that a large portion of the African American community does suffer from, you know, or a family member, someone or someone who has a family member suffers with mental illness. And speaking from my own family, I had two uncles that suffered from mental illness. Except one of my uncles, they both have passed away. They both have passed away now, but one of my uncles, his mental illness was caused by a brain tumor. And, you know, of course his was caused by a brain tumor. And at that time, my grandmother didn't have the money for all that expensive testing and everything like that. But, you know, if we do have, if we're dealing with a mental illness or we have a family member that may deal with a possible mental illness. And what people have to understand, it does not have to be a mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar. A person can deal with an episode of depression. You know, it can be an episode of depression.
I'm depressed. I'm depressed. And people don't really know what depressed is. Could you define what depression is?
Well, depression, if you're speaking of just, you know, run-of-the-mill depression, because there are...
I'm talking about major depression.
Okay, well, with major depression, with major depression, there is a breakdown in functioning. A person who is dealing with major depression, they are not going to want... That means, when I say a breakdown of functioning, that means they can't work. They can't work. They, depending on the severity of it, some people won't even get out of bed and go shower. Major depression is kind of like those commercials that you see where for the depression, for those depression medication where the person gets out of
bed. Right.
So the person is walking around with a cloud, that dark cloud over their head. So I always show in my classes, I always show my students a cartoon from a newspaper. And it's a person who's suffering from depression. So when they get up, in the first panel, when they get out of bed, it's a black cloud, and the cloud puts on the human suit, the skin, the human suit of clothes. They get dressed, and they're wearing a smile. And then when they get back home, they unzip the human suit, and the black cloud gets back in the bed and cries. That is major depression. Major depression, like I said, is you know, the person, they try to function, but they're not actually functioning. And major depression, with major depression, it could last weeks, it could last months, it could last years. Along with that loss of functioning, there is a breakdown in health. You know, there's a loss of, not just say functioning as in going out interacting with people, there's a loss of body functioning also, because the person, they don't want to move, they don't want to do anything, they just have lost all of their, you could say, their zest for life. It's no longer there. And that's what, you know, we get depressed over. You know, a lot of people, when they say they're depressed, me and my boyfriend broke up, so I was depressed about that. But we get over that. That, you know, you can be depressed about the breakup or something or whatever, and then, you know, a week or two later, you're okay. But a person who's dealing with major depression, it doesn't go away that fast for them. You know, major depression is one of those things that can, you know, basically hospitalize a person because there's a breakdown. There's a breakdown within their mental capacity has broken down to where they can, you know, they can no longer operate. So we, you know, a lot of people, we use these terms, and a lot of people don't really understand the heavy meaning that comes behind those terms.
Right. Do you feel that the current mental health communities across this nation, and I know I'm really don't know the question at you, but do you feel that the mental health community is really benefiting the African-American community?
Oh, wow. That's a good one.
Yeah, I said I'm going to ask you a loaded question. And take your time because we get ready to wind it down in about a couple of minutes. So take your time with it.
Okay. I would say that the mental health community, I would say it could benefit the black community. And the reason why I say it could, we have to look at the
so
black
it's not.
First.
You say it's could, so it, therefore it's not.
Let's take it from this point. When I say
okay.
It could, it means when I say it could benefit the black community, it is because there are services there to help with mental health issues. But in the black community, and from my experience, and I've worked in mental health since for about 13 years now,
mm-hmm.
I have seen a resistance from the black community, because when a lot of black people hear mental health, we automatically think crazy.
Right.
That's not what mental health is. And there's that resistance or that hesitance that a lot of people from the black community have. But then there's also the church. And there's nothing now before, because I don't want nobody to jump on me, but there's nothing wrong with going to church. But if a person is battling a mental illness, that's going to be the first advice, the level of advice that someone is going to give them. Well, go to church. You know, go to church, get prayer. And I always tell, and I've told clients, there's nothing wrong with you going to church. Go to church, get prayer. But I tell them, you have to combine your prayer with the word to get better. And I said, you always have to remember, now the word tells us faith without works is dead. So I said, if you're not combining prayer with the word to get better, then how can you get better? And then there are those who, you know, from the church, who was like, well, I'm not going, I don't want to deal with any doctor. And I have told some clients, if your faith in God is as strong as you say it is, then you should take God with you when you walk through those doors at mental health to get help.
That's
and
right.
You should pray that doctor, that God has given that doctor the needed knowledge to help you with your mental illness. You know, there's that piece of it. And then there's that medication piece. A lot of people are afraid of the medication. And I completely understand
I am too. I really don't trust it. And the reason why, I remember back in the 80s, you know, like the buzz thing with ADHD. Everybody is ADHD. Mm-hmm. I have ADHD. You have ADHD. And that's what, and because of the misdiagnosis of people on ADHD, that's how special education, that's how special education grew. So proportionally just grew. And people, and I believe that, that people are still being misdiagnosed. They, like you said before, they need to change some of the evaluation tools that they are assessing, especially when it comes to us. Especially when it comes to us, and I'm sorry for cutting you off, especially when it comes to us.
You're fine.
Because the way you value it, with all different cultures and backgrounds, even the black community is different backgrounds, different culture in the African-American community. You got urban, suburban, rural, and you cannot administer the same evaluation to a black, to an African-American and to a white person. You can't do it. They're two different worlds. That argument came up with the SATs. It's culturally biased because of the background and experiences. And they teach us, we don't have the resources, and they teach us differently too. Just like they, in the mental health community, they provide a different level of care in our community compared to others. Sorry about that.
You're fine. You're fine. The level of care, you know, is there for the African American community.
Mm-hmm.
So what is happening, even in some mental health centers, with the majority of the staff being white, you still have reluctance from the black community. I worked for mental health in Union County. I worked there and I also interned there. I worked there as an intern. And there were until I was the only black person in the building. I was the only black
That's
person.
Still
the only
black.
That's
still going on? That's still going on? I can't believe.
And there were so many within the city of Union that once they saw me and they saw that I worked at mental health, there were some that were willing to come to mental, that were willing to come to mental health. And it's funny that you say that about how assessing, you know, someone black versus someone white. My supervisor at the time at mental health, she did not know how to communicate or how to talk with people that were from the project. You know, she's like, I don't know how to break through with them. They won't talk to me. And she's like, I don't understand. She's like, they're talking to you. I told her, you have to kind of, in a way, you have to speak their language. You have to relate to them. I told her, I have experienced some of the same things that they have experienced. I said, you know,
You have walked in their shoes.
Yes, and I told you, you don't have to talk to a person like they're stupid. I said they deserve respect just as you do. So I said you can't, because she had a bad habit of wanting to kind of dumb down her talk when talking to these people. Just talk to these people like they are human beings. You have to treat them like they're human in order for them to be accepting of what you have, the help that you have, the help and the knowledge that you have to give them.
Well, Professor Simpson, I really enjoyed our discussion, and I'm going to invite you back. And you got to get used to it, because next year you're getting the big paper, and you have to get used to go in front of the camera, on the people want to interview you, you know, because you're an expert. So I really want to thank you and for coming on the show, and I appreciate you for taking time out in your busy schedule.
Oh, you're welcome, sir. And, you know, it's funny that you say that, you know, that's what I told my wife. I was like, this is something I have to get used to. So I thank you for you know, asking me to come on, to think enough of me to have me on your show. And you happen to, you know, this is the first experience for me, and I actually enjoyed it. I'll be glad to come back.
I'm gonna message you sometime this week because I got a rough week ahead of me, and help you to get exposed to this audio world. Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Good night. Good night, Professor.
I've been
talking
with you.
Good
night. Thanks again.
All right.
Thanks again.
I can't believe that there are white counselors that still got this stigma about working with black folks. I can't believe there are teachers telling our black kids they can't do something. They can't follow their dream. I can't believe that our kids are not being taught appropriately, you know. And this is like the fourth educator that I had on this show within the last 2 months from different parts of the country. Not in one area, but different parts of the country. And we folks have to do something about that. Stay out them clubs and stay off them porches and start paying them attention to our children. That's what you have to do. It's such a very disheartening issue to constantly talk, but parents are going to have to start being accountable. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am.
Hold it
I
now.
Talk-